two objects. It is like God reaching out through something, bridging that last divide between divine and human, invisible and visible, spirit and flesh. These are points of contact, but they cannot be called sacraments, because that would be too Catholic, and it looks too Catholic already. When I was in college, my gloriously hippie friends loved to make a huge deal about the fact that I was a Christian. I had not yet realized that Americans choose colleges based on their personalities. Everything I knew about college at that point, I had picked up from the Saturday morning sitcom Saved by the Bell, and none of the characters had ever mentioned that delightfully liberal granola schools would not be filled with those who thought fondly of their years growing up in narrow-minded Christian towns. In fact, they would find you and your faith to be somewhat hilarious. And, for a semester, submit your campus mailing address to prosperity preachers around the country. When you went to open your mailbox, it would be full of spiritual handkerchiefs to place on an afflicted body part, green oil to rub on your forehead, fake gold coins to tuck into your shoes, or any number of things to put under your pillow. The prosperity gospel is a faith meant to be touched and held. I start to surround myself with things. Tobin builds a little shelf to go beside the bed so that I can reach for books as I lie there. There are a few rows of practical items to make me feel useful. Bottled water, light hand weights, and a stack of the latest American religious history titles. Everything else is a friend. Two icons, one the looming figure of Archangel Michael, and the other of Saint Peregrine, an Italian friar and the patron saint of cancer patients, shine, their cracked gold painted faces gazing at me. An old frame shows two blurry teenagers grinning at the camera. It was my first photo with Tobin, and we are jumping for some reason. A little wooden piano plays a delicate tune and holds old Canadian bills, tarnished necklaces, and polished rocks my grandfather once collected. And on a large black canvas, a hand-drawn sign quoting the heroine of my favorite television show reads, "It's so weird being my own role model." I surround myself with reminders, things I can touch, that remind me of a time when I was Kate, and she could get out of bed. Lying in my bed, I am trying to recover from surgery, but I have lost the habit of sleep. All the worst things happen in the dark. When I was in the hospital, I learned that when doctors want to tell you something, they will tell you at 4 a.m., when they start rounds and you are sleeping. And if it's really bad, they will send the person with the shortest lab coat. Seniority works in white coats, from the longest, read fanciest head doctor, to the shortest, read the greenest and most anxious doctor in the universe. So when I first heard how long I had to live, I drew the short coat. Apparently, in research hospitals, this is a teaching moment. Find the person having the worst moment of her or his life and send the intern. But my short coat was from Canada, so all mercy was granted. He sat down, and of everything he said, all I remembered was, "You have a 30 to 50% chance of survival." By their definition, survival meant 2 years of life. And everything in my mind blurred and slowed. All I could think of to say was, "If you're going to say stuff like that to me, you'd better be holding my hand." "Hold my hand," I kept thinking. "Don't give up on me just yet." Everything around me is nudging me toward giving up hope that I will make it through this year. I am in the cancer clinic for a quick checkup on my surgical stitches, and the physician assistant walks in. She moves through the pleasantries with enough warmth to suggest that, at least on social occasions, she considers herself to be a nice person. "How are you?" she asks, pressing on my stomach lacerations as I stifle a sharp intake of breath. It's hard, I say, pretending to read the posters on the wall to keep myself from choking up. Well, she says, getting up and tidying the supplies, the sooner you get used to the idea of dying, the better. I stare at her, but she is zooming around the room and out the door, on to the next unfortunate recipient of her care. I get up and make it out of the cancer clinic before I crumple in a heap on the wooden bench next to the front door. Sometime later, I will meet a woman with my same cancer and my same life, a husband and a toddler, and she will say the words I was feeling in that moment. Aren't I still standing here, holding this purse? Aren't I still stopping by the store to pick up ingredients for dinner tonight? I'm still real, aren't I? There was one point in the hospital, right after my surgery, when I was allowed to see Zach. In those 2 minutes, he looked up at me, furious and crying, with his hands in the air. He never screams, but he screamed at me because I was too weak to pick him up. And all I thought was, I can't leave you here, alone. It is an easy lie that has wormed its way into my mind. I am the center that must hold. It is a thought I picked up so early on in my life that I can't bring myself to question it. It is something closer to a reflex. Life is unstable because it is life, but I am steady. My mother-in-law likes to make art out of colored wires, and she made me something sweet to put by my bed. It is 3 dangling hearts hanging in a long chain. A pink heart, a blue heart, a silver heart. Me, Tobin, Zach. And when I saw it, I immediately believed it as a lie about our love. Yes, this all hangs on me. And it will all fall apart. My friend Carolyn and I are driving home from an appointment at the hospital a few weeks later, and she points to the local school as we drive by. Is that where Zach will go? She says. A normal question, said in a normal voice, to a woman who doesn't know what any of that means anymore. I don't know, honey. I don't know if Tobin and Zach will keep living here if I'm gone. They'll probably be in Canada. My mind has skipped ahead to a patch of land north and west of the first Mennonite settlements in Manitoba. Tobin's grandfather and uncle have a beautiful farm there, where the dirt is dark and rich, as deep as you can dig a grave. Rich as deep as you can dig a grave. It's one of those offhanded comments that Uncle Kurt makes when he talks about the land, his lightly inflected German accent twisting poetry into all the talk of grain and fixing the silo on one side of the property. Not far away is the buried history of this Mennonite settlement, an unassuming cluster of gravestones beside a ditch by an old highway. Every tour I have ever gotten of the area includes that graveyard, and the constant reminder that it sits where the wooden German schoolhouse was and the old Mennonite church used to be. There is an accidental beauty to being buried in the graveyard by the ditch, wedged between the memories of 2 institutions. If you want to get a plot there, you just have to call Abe from the town of Winkler, and he will dig one out for $250, including maintenance. It's a steal. All I want to tell Carolyn is that I don't know where Zach will be, but that she will probably find me between the ditch and the cornfield. But I can't tell her that. My brain is bouncing back and forth between 2 worn tracks. One set of plans that assume I will die, and another equally sure I will survive. I make preparations just in case. I choose a preacher for my eulogy during a long, quiet moment. Surrender seems like such a Christian word, as if I were letting go and sinking into the arms of God. Presbyterians, who are known for their staunch belief that God is the benevolent dictator of all that is good, would weep for joy at anyone who described herself as surrendered. From the Presbyterian point of view, I am a passive vehicle of God's grace. Like the lamb in Sunday school artwork, I am an adorable, woolly passenger on Jesus' shoulders. To believers in the prosperity gospel, surrender sounds like defeat. They write books with titles like Deal With It to remind readers that there is nothing so difficult that God cannot accomplish it, and that you, sir or ma'am, had better get cracking. There are no setbacks, just setups. There are no trials, just tests of character. Tragedies are simply opportunities to claim a bigger, better miracle. I often wonder if the prosperity gospel's never-give-up spirit produces resilient believers. Does it make happier people? Do people find themselves emboldened, shielded from the trials of daily life by the promise that they are more than conquerors? I can't tell. All I know is that a cheerful person can look a lot like someone with total mastery over everything that would weigh a lesser person down. At the hospital, I can always spot prosperity believers by their desk space, because there will inevitably be post-its taped around their monitors with little positive sayings. You can't change the past, but you can change the future. Or scripture. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. The nurses are harder to identify, but come out like preachers if I happen to say anything negative. As they say, you gotta name it and claim it, said one nurse as she was drawing blood. I just know that everything is going to work out. Control is a drug, and we are all hooked. Whether or not we believe in the prosperity gospel's assurance that we can master the future with our words and attitudes. I can barely admit to myself that I have almost no choice but to surrender, but neither can those around me. I can hear it in my sister-in-law's voice as she tells me to keep fighting. I can hear it in my academic friends who do what researchers do and Google the hell out of my problem. When did the symptoms start? They ask. Is this hereditary? Buried in all their concern is the unspoken question. Do I have any control? A friend of a friend stops by with heaps and heaps of kale and flies around the kitchen with instructions about how to harness its healing properties. She is trying her best, I can see that, but I am slumped against the counter, half listening in a fog of pain medication. Friends keep sending me recipes for green drinks and quinoa salads, and others ship herbal supplements straight to my house. Just try, they are saying. You can eat your way out of this. Tobin and I get into a stupid fight when he finds me eating a huge, puffy Rice Krispies treat. Don't I know that sugar causes cancer? He doesn't even believe that food has caused my particular cancer, but all this talk of nutrition has infected him with a poisonous hope. Maybe I can be the cure. Infertility and disability should have taught me how to surrender, taught me how little I can control the conditions of my own happiness. Instead, that helplessness has only thickened my resolve to salvage what I can from the wreckage. If the physiotherapist says one lap, I do two. When the doctor says you'll be out in 4 days, I push for three. I would like to blame it on some charming quirk. I'm plucky. But it's more than that. I don't know how to stop. When I was little, my dad would read stories from Greek mythology, and I loved one most of all, that prideful king Sisyphus, who was doomed to roll a boulder up an impossibly steep hill only to have it roll down again. He would discover for all eternity that not every burden can be shouldered. Yes, I would think, learning nothing, But at least he kept trying. My two best friends from Canada come with me for my first chemotherapy treatment, and, like only best friends can, immediately invent nicknames for everyone we meet. There is Chipper Chad and Needle Nancy, but after a grim presentation by one of the nurses, Exaggerator Eve is born for her chilling words. I noticed that when people in chemotherapy get tired and take a nap, they never get up. If I never nap, if I never complain, if I stifle my sharp intake of breath when I feel the pain, if I hide the reality, then maybe I'm not sick. So I continue to work full days. I get up at 6:30 a.m. every day, no matter what, so I won't miss a moment with my son. When I stop taking the medication that minimizes the numb feeling in my hands and feet, because I want to feel every shred of what is happening to me, my friends practically stage an intervention. When will I realize that surrender is not weakness? St. Teresa of Avila once said, "We can only learn to know ourselves and do what we can, namely, surrender our will and fulfill God's will in us." For Christians, not of the prosperity persuasion, surrender is a virtue. The writings of the saints are full of commands to let go and to submit yourself to what seems to be the will of the Almighty. All of American culture and pop psychology scream against that. Never give up on your dreams. Just keep knocking. That door is about to open. Think positively. Self-improvement guaranteed. The entire motivational speaking industry rests on the assumption that you can have what you want, you can be what you want. Just do it. When prosperity believers live out their daily struggles with smiles on their faces, sometimes I want to applaud. They confront the impossible and joyfully insist that God make a way. They obediently put miracle oil on their failing bodies. They give large offerings to the church and expect great things. They stubbornly get out of their hospital beds and declare themselves healed. And every now and then, it works. They are addicted to self-rule. And so am I. Chapter 6, Christmas Cheer. The long dawn of Advent will soon begin, and now we are all learning to wait. Christmas is coming, and the baby Jesus will be born, but for now, we must sit in the darkness. I come from a Christmas home. I'm sure other people will say that they are Christmas enthusiasts, but I say this with all sincerity. They are deceived. When I was growing up, we ate, breathed, and slept December 25th. If there was a song to sing, it was a Christmas carol. If there was an inflatable member of the nativity scene that could be added to our front yard, it was waving in the wind. And if there was a pause on a long car ride on a hot July afternoon, it was because my dad was trying to come up with another way to ask, "Who is your favorite wise man?" Years ago, my dad started writing Christmas trivia quizzes for parties, and these grew into a number of historical books about Santa Claus and Christmas controversies, as well as a global encyclopedia of the holiday. These cost him 10 years and roughly 600 Christmas ornaments bought for academic reasons. There is nothing my family loves more than our white Canadian Christmases in our crappy bungalow, surrounded by blow-up Christmas figures that belong outside a car dealership. This year, I need Christmas, but not Christmas as usual. I need a miracle somewhat smaller than God becoming a baby and somewhat bigger than the promises of the Duke doctor who keeps using the word palliative. Then, At one of our appointments, Dr. Palliative mentions that there are a few variables that might change the course of my treatment. 90% of people with advanced colon cancer will receive chemotherapy and get their limited chance at life beyond 5 years. But there are two other options. I might be among the 7% of people who will have a disorder in which cancer cells multiply beyond control so quickly that there is no treatment at all. It is an automatic death sentence. Or I might be among the remaining 3% who have a variation on that disorder that opens them up to possible new treatments. They'll give me a call in a couple of weeks and let me know. So I either maybe live, die almost immediately, or have some kind of magic cancer that gets special treatments, I ask.
Pretty much, he says.
Okay, I say. They have already drawn blood, and now I just have to wait for the results. As it turns out, the results come back in a couple of days, but I am too preoccupied to check my voicemail like a normal person. I get the news a week later, sitting outside, wrapped in blankets, fiddling with my phone. Hi, this is a call from the cancer clinic. We got your results back. The doctor said to tell you that you have the magic cancer and that you'd know what that meant. I freeze. And then I play it again. And then one more time, I start to yell, I have the magic cancer! I have the magic cancer! Tobin comes running out of the house, and I sink into his arms, crying. We are both trying to smile with that weary look of people overwhelmed by the prospect of hope. I might have a chance, I manage to say between sobs. I might have a chance. He hugs me tightly, resting his chin on my head. And then he releases me to let me sing Eye of the Tiger and do a lot of punching the air because it is in my nature to do so. The magic cancer, as it turns out, is a complicated gene mismatch repair disorder that I only partially understand. It is my ticket into clinical trials testing drugs not yet on the market. There is a trial opening up in the next few weeks, 7 hours away in Atlanta, at Emory University, and Dr. Now Not Saying Palliative has sent my files there to start the application process. Before I can find out whether I'll make it into the trial, however, I need to get my medical insurance to cover it. About an hour after I hear the news, I begin to work the phones, slowly making my way through all the customer service representatives in the Emory and Duke insurance systems. Each university has a chain of people accustomed to saying no, or, as I am beginning to suspect, they are evil robots masquerading as humans, programmed to decline your every reasonable request. I try everything. My premium insurance will not cover anything outside of the Duke hospital system. I'm too poor to pay for it myself, but I don't qualify for charity care because I'm not American. No matter how I parse it, paying as I go until I can get new insurance in January, just 2 months away, will cost me upward of $100,000. I know because I have had them price out the treatment down to every needle and scan. By mid-afternoon, there was no one left to call, and the trial is not going to consider me without promise of payment. Either I have to come up with an impossible sum of money in the next few weeks, or I will never get into the trial. And all my hopes built on magic cancer disappear into the ether. I slam the phone down at the end of the last call, blood boiling. I turn toward my parents. They have been staying with me since the surgery, trying to entertain Zach, keep the refrigerator full, and take me to my hospital visits. Don't worry, says my dad, putting down his book. Your mother and I have $140,000 in liquid assets. I will find out only later that my family have all appraised their homes and savings plans. Every last one of them. To see what they can cobble together to save my life. My best shot at survival will bankrupt my family. But my father keeps that impassive face and neutral voice that he always uses when everything is splitting at the seams. He has put his retirement and savings on the table to wager on a chance, any chance, for his daughter. But all I can see is cancer turning everyone upside down and shaking the pennies out of their pockets. Cancer wants to take it all. I am not a normal person, I yell. It's a non sequitur. I don't know what it means, but I flush with rage and embarrassment when I realize that I'm shouting at the man who has spent most of his life working jobs beneath him to pay for my school, to buy my books, and to get me those juice boxes I like. I storm out of the house. I pace through the backyard in the cooling air, weighing the math. I can't pay for this myself. Nothing plus nothing keeps equaling nothing. I sit down on a bench and curl my knees into my chest. I have a terrible premonition that at the end of this, once every stone is upturned and every drug tried, my family will have nothing left. I feel like an anvil dropped, crushing everything on its way down. I know it like I know the weight of my son's sleeping body in my arms. I will be the reason for the tall paper stacks of bills on the desk in the study, the second mortgage on my parents' aging home, the slope of their backs as they walk a little more heavily. They will carry my death in their checkbooks, vacations deferred, sleepless nights, and the silence of Sunday morning prayers when there is no daughter left to pray for. I am the death of their daughter. I am the death of his wife. I am the end of his mother. I am the life interrupted. Amen. This will be my first Christmas away from Canada, away from my church on the one night when all the wanderers who no longer attend return to hug one another and sing carols like only Mennonites can, in growly German and perfect four-part harmony. I have always loved the darkness and the candles during Silent Night. Mostly I love the feeling of homecoming I get when I see Liz, who designed my prom dress in a shiny lavender polysatin, and Ferd, who quietly nailed the cross back together after my friend and I accidentally broke it in an ill-advised reenactment of the crucifixion on a youth group overnight. I never told my parents, and, God bless them, neither did Ferd. I look forward to getting a fierce hug from Charlotte, my mom's best friend, and my old Sunday school teacher, Carol, who helped me get into my sheep costume for the Christmas pageant year after year. A couple of Christmases ago, I saw Carol over one of the pews and reached out to give her a hug, remembering only at the last second that she had recently been diagnosed with cancer. I couldn't figure out what to say when we pulled away, and I found I was just staring into her smiling face, stammering something about how sorry I was. She looked back at me with such calm and said something I had never heard anyone say. I have known Christ in so many good times, she said, sincerely and directly, and now I will know him better in his sufferings. She meant it, and I could not imagine a world in which I could mean it. It was Christmas, and I was busy with presents, coffee dates, and rushing between family gatherings. It was only part way through the service that I had begun to hope that that Christmas feeling would sink in as the night gathered and the music slowed. The angels were singing, and the wise men were on their way, and all the church was ready for Jesus to be born, but I hardly noticed. I wasn't asking God for anything in particular. Carol surely wanted healing and more years with her husband and an escape from the creeping death that is multiplying cells and the fading powers of chemotherapy drugs. Yet she prayed for more than to be saved. She prayed in the long night of Advent that her waiting would end with a better angle of vision on the baby born to die. Tobin encouraged me to put up the Christmas tree in October, and we trimmed the house with toasted pine cones, bushy evergreen branches, and golden baubles. First thing in the morning, Zach loves to sprint from his room, his chubby arms pumping, to make sure he is there when I flick on the lights to the tree. He laughs maniacally every time, tossing his head back with an evil ha ha ha, like Vincent Price. I taught him how to do that, and I have never regretted it. Then he pulls a thick blanket over to where I am sitting and tucks us both into it. He looks up at me and smiles broadly. God, I don't want to just know you better. I want to save my family. Still sitting on the outdoor bench with my phone, I shoot off an email to the only two professors I know with some connections to the hospital. I tell them that I've been turned down by insurance and that I'm at the end of what I can do. My mind is circling around the same obsessive thought. I am ruining everything for everyone I love. Both professors write back immediately with just a few words. I'm on it. Let me see what I can do. The thing I love most about my friends is summed up by their reaction to my ridiculous request. Later, one of them will tell me exactly what he had said to himself. Thank God, something I can do. Their love has arms and legs and momentum. Their love has reach. As it turns out, they will shake the bushes for me. They will email everyone they know, and, after my useless efforts to get anyone to even talk to me, I watch with equally helpless shock as the emails start to pour in. Emails from famous people with Wikipedia pages and their names on buildings. These two professors pull the right levers and know whom to ask. They have pleaded for me at every level of these institutions, and within 24 hours, I have multiple assurances from what feels like the queen on down to the janitor that I will see only green lights from now on. My family will be spared. I might be saved. I have squeezed through the cracks in the system and found my way back into the sun, even though, really, I have done nothing at all. It has all been done for me. The prosperity gospel has a word for that feeling that God is on your side. It's called favor in a very particular sense. When a man stands up in a church service to testify that his boss gave him the company car and free gas to go visit his ailing father, shouts of favor, favor erupt from the congregation. When a woman tells a friend that her bid for a house she would like to buy has been accepted, despite heavy competition, her friend whoops with a cry of favor. The wind is at your back. It's what insiders claim is the protection of God at every turn, but outsiders might simply call luck. I'm not a normal person, one of them might say. With the insurance obstacles clearing, the clinical trial folks ask me to come down for a preliminary screening, or, as I start to call it, my tryout. They want to take my blood, run some tests, and see if I qualify as a desirable candidate in their selective study. Now I am just worried that I might be disqualified because I am still bleeding from my surgery incisions. I am trying to keep that to myself, but at one point even I have to admit that I am not doing terribly well, and Tobin drives me to the emergency room late at night. A kindly doctor lets me skip the hours-long wait and leads us into what amounts to a spare closet with a flickering fluorescent light, a single chair, and no supplies. He is doing me a favor, seeing me with no notice, and has to scrounge for what he needs before he asks me to lift my shirt and show him what we're dealing with.
It's gross, because it is infected, and we all know it, but I am determined to make small talk to show my appreciation for his efforts and not make a peep about the treatment. The treatment, as it turns out, hurts so much that it makes my eyes water. It looks a lot like someone trying to squeeze wine out of grapes by hand, and sounds a lot like mash, 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 which makes Tobin gag as I'm trying to look around pleasantly and comment on the state of world news. When the doctor steps back, it looks like a murder scene. But for some reason, the whole thing is so funny to me that once Tobin stops retching into his cupped hands, I resolve to stow it away in the memory bank as fun in retrospect. My nerves are on edge on the morning of my departure. I wake up and pack the wounds as quietly as possible before I go downstairs to lift my tiny human out of his crib. I grind the coffee beans while Zach and I yell at the top of our lungs to match the pitch of the grinder. We do it every day, and I'd like to think we're getting better at it. I hate to leave him for these few days of testing, as everything still feels too precious, and this love makes me clingy and tender. But my dad and I pack our things and say our goodbyes, promising that we will stop at every oversized landmark and text everyone with any bit of news. Cancer clinics try to be places of encouragement, and for that we can offer them a slow hand clap. But mostly, they are encounters with death, set to the tune of a young volunteer on the lobby's baby grand piano, and the muffled sounds of someone yelling, "Mr. Smith, it's your turn for blood work!" When I heard a harp player in the foyer, I immediately turned to my dad and said, "Is it really that bad?" Pale and puffy, the patients lean their heads on the hard edges of the seats beside them, or sink onto the bony shoulders of their companions. Everyone looks up when a name is called, momentarily revived. There are wheelchairs everywhere, and bald, wrinkled women in bright kerchiefs, and someone coughing blood beside a mural that reads, "Laughter is the best medicine." Lord, I hope not. Everyone I meet is kind and efficient, and I try to accept what is happening like it's my first day of work. The bruising needle marks will go away, I tell myself, and the scan was not so bad because I made Sam, the technician, tell me his life story. "Start at the beginning," I said, as he injected the dye. "Leave nothing out." He took that so seriously that by the time I had left the room, he had just been born. Then there is nothing left to do. The doctors will review the charts and let me know if I qualify. As we walk past the sign for the cancer clinic, I stop my dad and hand him my phone. "Take a picture, Dad. When I get in the trial, people are going to want to see me in this moment." I raise my clasped hands in the air in a gesture of salute and plaster a huge smile on my face. It is getting colder out, even in Atlanta, and it occurs to me that it is autumn, and I might not get another summer. I grit my teeth into a bigger smile. He takes a few pictures, and we walk to the car quietly, before my dad breaks the silence to ask me something I love about Christmas. But I can already feel the shape of a question looming in my mind. Who takes a picture of something she is begging God for? In the darkness of the car ride home to my family, and the baby asleep in his bed, I can't help but think about the person in the photo, who pretended she wasn't on the edge of dying. Her cheerfulness, her sunny-side-up Facebook posts, brimming with positivity and gently ironic updates. Is that really me? "I am not a normal person," I had shouted, to myself and to my father and to God. Even though I did not solve my own insurance debacle or create the biology to have magic cancer, I have still somehow clung to the idea that I am able to save myself. To my friends and family, I sugarcoat the truth with spiritual-sounding assurances and good cheer. There is an inchoate sadness in the pit of my stomach, hard to express. I try to focus on the more superficial things that are out of my control. I feel sick when I look at the crisscrossing scars on my stomach. I hate running my fingers through my hair because I can feel the light tearing of my scalp and see the little tufts of hair that come off in my hands. I walk past a gym and watch the women work out as if I'm an alien who crash-landed on a planet of the carefree and healthy. I know I am going to be getting chemotherapy no matter what, but when it was announced that I would be wearing a giant sack filled with chemotherapy fluid in a bag around my waist, attached to a giant needle that goes into the port beside my heart, I am just thrilled to be bringing fanny packs back into style. And since I always need to wear my backpack to carry my medical equipment, I am essentially wearing bags on bags on bags. "Some women bedazzle it," says an older nurse, helpfully. "Yes, this certainly needs a heck of a lot more rhinestones," I say, looking it over. "Something that says blessed or something."
"Or something," says the nurse, and we silently agreed that it is hideous in all its forms.
When I started chemotherapy, I tried to hide all its varieties of ugliness. I posted pretty self-portraits on Facebook and named my portable chemo pack Jimmy, after I saw former President Jimmy Carter at the Cancer Center twice and announced to everyone that we would develop a lifelong friendship. Everyone knew that Kate had cancer, and that for her, it was basically a special pass to understand the life and times of Jimmy Carter. People had something to ask about and to point to that was sweet and funny. No one had to lead with, "So, you have cancer." Instead, it was always, "So, how's Jimmy?" I couldn't stand that people might see through me, that they might know I was only another tired cancer patient with a creeping sense of hopelessness and the glorious delusion that sheer willpower would make the difference. In the storefront prosperity church I studied for years, the congregation managed the spectacle of pain with ceaseless positivity. A singer's congested voice can't hit the high notes, and other women begin to shout encouragement. A woman slumps into her seat, and the people around her start to sing about how far she's come to the tune of "Look What the Lord Has Done." An elder once preached his Sunday school message on this determined joy by imitating a limping man still shouting with delight that he was already healed. He could limp his way by utter determination into God's favor. When I think about where sheer grit has gotten me, I can't help but remember standing in the parking lot outside my pregnancy education class, 7 months pregnant, having a panic attack. Somehow the reality of my already massive baby making a massive exit sent me completely over the edge, and I ran out of the room, trying not to lose it in front of a gaggle of overly fashionable, soon-to-be moms. But then Tobin gave me the greatest speech ever given, which, looking back, I realized sounded a lot like the battle cry from Shakespeare's Henry V, "We few, we happy few," but ended with, "Look at them!" He pointed dramatically through the window at the women taking the class. "Do any of them look like they can crank out an enormous baby? Those little wimps? One lady just asked for filtered water, Kate.
filtered water!
I started to laugh, which meant that I had started to breathe again.
You are going to go back in there and learn to have this baby!
And then we marched back in there with Tobin, quietly percussing the theme song to Chariots of Fire. I have been all kinds of cheery, but positivity has become a burden. And it's a burden I assumed when I decided that, in the darkness of Advent, I would save myself. At the end of the week, I get a phone call from Emery saying that I have qualified for the study. My parents shout and dance, and Tobin picks Zach up and twirls him around like a carousel horse. See, I say to my dad, I am not a normal person. No, he says softly, reaching out to pull me to him. You're a superhero, but I wish you didn't have to be. Chapter 7. Certainty. The treatment at Emory begins at the end of October. I am tired most of the time, but I feel driven to catalog everything and wring every bit of time for all it's worth. I start to write. In bed, in chemo chairs, in waiting rooms. I try to say something about dying in a world where everything happens for a reason. Whenever there is a clarifying moment of grief, I jot it down. And then, in a flurry, I shoot it off to the New York Times, not thinking too much about whether it's any good, but sending it because I have been infected by the urgency of death. Then an editor there sees it and puts it on the front page of the Sunday Review. Millions of people read it. Thousands share it and start writing to me, and most begin with the same words. I'm afraid. Me too. Me too. I'm afraid of the loss of my parents, writes a young man. I know I will lose them someday soon, and I can't bear the thought. I'm afraid for my son, says a father from Arkansas. He has been diagnosed with a brain tumor at 44, which would have been devastating enough if he had not already lost his identical twin brother to the same disease a few years ago. These letters sing with unspeakable love in the face of the great separation. Don't go, don't go. You anchor my life. It feels as though the world has been cracked open, and it bleeds and bleeds. Hundreds of emails, letters, pictures and videos pour into my inbox and campus mailbox. A mother writes about her son dying young of lung cancer. He never smoked. A nurse has survived 10 years past her stage 4 cancer diagnosis, but her healthy husband dies suddenly one day from an undetected brain bleed. A middle-aged woman has buried her son after watching bill collectors hunt him. And hospitals, whose treatments would have saved his life, reject him. A check for Medicaid arrives in the mail 9 days after his death. Strangers pour out their fury at every stage of their own grief. Depression settles on the pages like a fog. A young man writes, I guess I was hoping that God would make something of this. But it has come to nothing. The void is deep and bottomless, and it is an unmerciful fact that some people have the right to look into my eyes and say, you're lucky. A young woman gently explains to me that cancer has stolen her fertility only months before she met the love of her life. If ever she shakes the disease, even for a little, she will try to adopt. Hold your son close. You're so fortunate to have him.
There is plenty of denial and plenty of the deals people attempt to broker with God. I am an atheist, but I put it aside and I begged God to take the cancer away from my son and to put it into me. I read that letter to my dad, who was sitting in an overstuffed leather chair in my living room, holding his Kindle 2 inches from his glasses. Oh, I've prayed that 100 times. Please, God, why not just take me? He says a little wistfully. I scoot over beside him and rest my head on his knee. Dad, that is about the kindest, saddest thing I've ever heard. There is a gentle silence between us, as I imagine that we are both thinking about how much we love each other, before my dad begins to speak. But then I remember that God didn't spare Mozart at your age, so... He is making a gesture that suggests he is weighing a heavy object in each hand. So, you know, I start to laugh. What did he die of? The plague, I think. Oh, jeez. Yeah, and God loves you at least as much as Mozart. Let's go back to loving each other in silence. A hilarious number of letters basically start with, "You think you have it bad? Listen to this," followed by a litany of complaints. The weirdest part is not simply that, yes, I do feel stage 4 cancer is a bit rough, but that these are letters written by people at the ends of long lives. A 73-year-old woman named Trudy writes me to say that cancer can't be nearly as terrible as learning she was adopted. Okay. Can't they both be bad? The pain of the world is being calculated, and, according to some, compassion can be doled out only by the teaspoon. I can't fully understand the people who write to say that, sorry, their lives have been grand. I receive long accounts of how deeply satisfied some people are with their many, many achievements. Younger by the day, boasts an elderly pastor. But many people write to me like family. As a father, I am truly sorry. I'm a mother, and I wish I could give you a hug right now. They want to comfort me, but their experiences tell them that life is never fair. I want you to know how much I'm praying for you and grateful for your faith. I'm sorry that we must say, like Job, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Yes, 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 yet will I trust in him. I don't know what the word trust means anymore, except that there are moments when I realize that it feels a lot like love. I've been in treatment for 5 months, and now it is Palm Sunday. When we get to church, the children's Sunday school is closed, so we are faced with the terror of having a 2-year-old in the main Sunday service. The sanctuary is swimming with children. They spin in circles. They climb on top of each other, but mostly they hit each other with palm fronds. In Christian art, a palm frond is a symbol of martyrdom, a little reminder to the viewer that this saint has earned his or her status in blood. But at every Palm Sunday service, the only whiff of martyrdom is the sense that every child is about 3 seconds from getting a palm frond in the eyeball. A tired volunteer still manages a smile and hands one to my 2-year-old, who is delighted. Suddenly, the organ music swells and the doors fly open and the procession has begun. It is, as all children's programming is, completely absurd and wonderful. Some children refuse to move past the pews that hold their parents. Others sprint ahead. 3 begin to cry. But most are trying to hit their brothers in the eye. Zach is utterly still,
as he takes in the view. I know what he is seeing. His small world has not yet included vaulted ceilings and warm wooden beams and window after window of colored glass. One of his arms is wrapped around my neck, and the other is pointing everywhere as his wide blue eyes scan the room. We march up to the front of the sanctuary. Everyone is smiling broadly as they stomp around the room. So taken are we by the spectacle of radiant youth that nobody is looking at the hymnal, and the space fills with loud, unself-conscious singing. I catch Tobin's eye as I hold Zach like a prize lamb, and I can tell he is trying not to cry. We are thinking the same thing. Is this one of those moments? The kind that he will have to look back on alone? I hold Zach up a little higher so he can wave his frond in the air, and I try to smile as a few tears trickle down my cheeks. I know where Palm Sunday falls in the story of our God. Jesus is on a donkey, trudging into Jerusalem, people waving their arms in the air, tattered coats thrown down before the one who marches toward his death. It is a celebration. It is a funeral procession. Holding Zach in my arms, 15 days from my next scan, I wish I knew the difference. My inbox is full of strangers giving reasons. People offer them to me like wildflowers they picked along the way. A few people want me to cultivate spiritual acceptance. We have had many millions of births and deaths in different life forms, explains a Hindu woman gently. Don't worry. This life shall pass, and your soul will move forward to its next step. The world is a place of suffering, they write. A garden full of weeds that we tend as best we can. But most everyone I meet is dying to make me certain. They want me to know, without a doubt, that there is a hidden logic to this seeming chaos. Even when I was still in the hospital, a neighbor came to the door and told my husband that everything happens for a reason. I'd love to hear it, he replied. Pardon? She said, startled. The reason my wife is dying, he said in that sweet and sour way he has, effectively ending the conversation as the neighbor stammered something and handed him a casserole. Christians want me to reassure them that my cancer is all part of a plan. A few letters even suggest that God's plan was that I get cancer so I could help people by writing the New York Times article. There is a circular logic to these attempts to explain the course of any life. If you inspire people while dying, the plan for your life was that you would become an example to others. If you don't, and you die kicking and screaming, the plan was that you discover some important divine lessons. Either way, learn to accept God's plan. It is at moments like this, when I feel everyone's eyes on me, watching my progress and my attitude for signs of the gospel, that I am gripped with fear. If I hear the news, if the scan comes back and the oncologist says that my days won't be renewed, will I scream or sit quietly? Will I feel peace or will I beat the ground? God, will you make a fool of me? What if everything is random? A woman who has left the faith for science writes, I find it comforting to believe the universe is random, because then the God I believe in is no longer cruel. This is a painful conclusion for so many who comb through the details of their tragedies and find no evidence that God was ever there.
The world, it seems, is also filled with fathers and mothers begging for their children's lives.